This is Jim Inkster. Coming today on the show, we are scheduled to hear from Peter Sagal, the host of Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, coming to the Baton Rouge River Center next week, courtesy of WRKF. Also on the show, Armin Katayan, the veteran sports writer, formerly with Sports Illustrated. His book is The System, The Glory and Scandal of Big Time College Football. And the 40th anniversary of the death of Jim Croce is today. Jim Croce was only 30 years old when he died on September 20th, 1973 in Natchitoches. Today there will be ceremonies in Natchitoches commemorating the tragedy of 40 years ago. And we'll hear from Gene Shea, a longtime and legendary disc jockey from Philadelphia who knew Jim Croce and liked his music. And we'll talk with him. Now the news on WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge, 297-5633 or 877-217-5757. Inkster's show at WRKF.org if you would prefer to reach us online. And we begin with a special treat. Mr. Peter Sagal, the host of Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, heard every week on WRKF. And Peter and his fine crew will be on stage at the Baton Rouge River Center Thursday. That's next Thursday, September 26th at 7:30 p.m. There are still tickets remaining if you would like to see the event. It is quite a spectacle when Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me comes to town. Good morning, Peter Sagal.
Good morning. How are you?
Doing great. You've been doing this for, what, about 15 years now?
About that. Yeah, I became the host of the show in May of 1998.
May of 1998, so according to my math, that's a bit more than 15 years.
Yeah, I know.
it's a show that has taken a life of its own. I'm sure you're heartened by it, but are you in any way surprised at how successful this franchise has become?
I guess the modest thing would be to say yes, but in fact, the truthful thing would be to say yes. Although I do like the idea of it taking on a life of its own. It's like it became self-aware and started to focus life. I think that would be amusing. When I became the host of the show, it was a small show. It was only on 10 or 15 stations nationwide, and the initial reviews were not positive. So we really didn't have any faith in a lengthy future, let's say. So we kind of decided, the producers at that time and myself, to just enjoy ourselves until they stopped us. And I guess the real surprise is that people out there in public radio land found the same stupid things funny that we did. It was like, oh my God, we're not the only ones who think this is hilarious kind of moment. It was very comforting in that way. So here we are some years later, and it turns out there are a lot of folks out there who have the same dumb sense of humor that we do.
Well, I've already gotten an email stating, I think correctly, that you were not the original host, though. There was someone very briefly before you, if I remember right.
Yeah, what happened was they did a national search, and they found a really qualified guy who was the initial host of the show. The show was launched with this guy as a host, and it didn't work out too terrifically well. And they were kind of desperate. It was like one of those war movies in which, you know, like those World War II movies in which the commander gets killed and they have to turn to this green guy to take over the platoon. It was like a battlefield promotion. I was their last hope, and it turns out I did okay.
Well, I think you have to have varied interests to be successful at this, and certainly you do. Peter is a playwright, a screenwriter, an actor, and he has written one of the most captivating titles of a book of all time, the Book of... The Book of Vice, Very Naughty Things and How to Do Them.
Yes.
Yeah, it was a successful book, and it fits your personality. In addition to all that, you're a marathon runner.
I am, in fact. In a couple of weeks, I'll be running the Twin Cities Marathon up in St. Paul, Minnesota, Minneapolis. It's a good sport for me because I have no particular athletic talent. I'm just kind of stubborn, and that works well for long-distance running. There's an old saying, it's like, those who can't play sports run, those who can't run, run long, and that suits me.
Well, you're good at running the streets and running your mouth, Peter Sagal.
I am actually going to use that quote on the back cover of my next book.
Okay. Well,
thank you.
I'm all for that.
I appreciate it.
You were near the explosions when the Boston Marathon had its tragedy.
I was. I've had an interesting year. I had run the marathon, the Boston Marathon, in April as a guide for a blind runner named William Greer out of Austin, Texas. And we finished the marathon, you know, he finishing it, me right behind him as his guide, at 4 hours and 4 minutes. And he was pretty exhausted. He had had a tough run, as you often do in Boston, and kind of doubled over and was trying to catch his breath and was moving very slowly. So 5 minutes later, at 4:09 on the clock, when the bombs went off, we were only about 100 yards beyond the finish line. And we were standing there, and all of a sudden there was this enormous boom. From our perspective, it was the other side of the finish line. I had no idea what it was. I had run a bunch of marathons, and there tend not to be loud explosions at the end of them. So I was a little concerned. But I have to admit that the last thing I ever thought it could be would be a terrorist bomb. You know, I mean, how often does that happen? Mm. What are the chances? My mother was always worrying that when I was growing up that something terrible was about to happen. And my reaction was always to say, Ma, come on, nothing bad is happening. Come on. So that was my attitude. Like, oh, it couldn't be. Come on, I'm sure it was just, although I couldn't think of anything it could be. And, of course, because of our position, we could not see the carnage that it actually caused. But it really wasn't until later, when I was looking at video from the scene, that I realized how relatively close I had come to a real disaster. It was quite sobering, but mildly.
My goodness. I'm sure, has impacted you to this day and will for the rest of your life. And
well, it does. It's a weird thing to be so close to something so terrible and yet to walk away completely unscathed. I mean, I can't consider myself a victim. The victims of that bombing are the people who were seriously injured. I'm not even really a witness. I didn't see all the things that there was to see. I was just nearby. I was a bystander. And fate spared me any real damage, so I can't complain. But I do think about it a lot, I'll say that.
Well, we're looking forward to your arrival here, and obviously this is a show that has a national appeal, and when it comes to town, it is a huge event, and it is a huge event for those of us in Baton Rouge. Do you know who will be coming with you? Who will the panelists be?
That's a good question. I only know off the top of my head one of our panelists, which is Tom Baudet. The good news is Tom Baudet is reason enough himself for you to come, so really Tom should be all the incentive anybody needs. I should have checked this morning to see who's traveling with us. I usually don't know until they show up. I'm like, oh, hello, guys. But I do know, and this is very exciting, we felt that coming to Baton Rouge, which I should say I've never been to before, many, many trips to Louisiana, to New Orleans, but never to Baton Rouge. So this is very exciting for me. Mm-hmm. I understand you're the really fun city, so I'm looking forward to that. And we decided that coming to Baton Rouge, you can't leave town without talking about LSU, and so we decided to talk to an LSU graduate, a guy by the name of James Carville, his name is.
I
believe he was class of 70 and a law school grad. So, you know, we'll be talking to him about his time at the university and whatever else he's been up to since then.
Well, that's great. You got a good one in James Carville. What about this fellow? Yes. What about this fellow, Carl Castle?
Now, Carl Castle is, of course, as I'm sure your listeners know, an absolute wild man. And for a long time, we really worried about taking him on the road because you never knew what was going to happen with Carl, how many hotel rooms he would crash. I mean, this is public radio. We can't really afford the bail every time we go on the road. And, you know, it was just so many times, you know, we'd look around for Carl, we'd get the phone call, we'd go down to the jail, and he'd stroll out with a smile on his face. You know, he'd tip the warden. No, and he slowed down a little. He's in his late 70s. Carl is, of course, the nicest man in the world, the most gentlemanly gentleman in the world. And let me say this, and I say this with no small envy, an absolute babe magnet. And I mean, I consider myself a relatively attractive man, you know, but the women rush at us in the manner of like the Beatles, right?
Yeah.
And then just to us, they just all funnel over to Carl and swarm him, tearing to get a little piece of his cardigan. It's you know, I just understand that I am the second banana here, and that's all there is.
Well, so Carl's cardigan is saturated with sex appeal.
And it is. I think it's something about those that the pheromones, you know, coming out of that deep resonant voice. I think it calls to the ladies. What can I tell you?
Yeah, I think you're onto something, Peter. What about Carl Book? What was the origin of Carl Book?
I don't know. Carl Book.
You know, the Facebook thing that he does.
Oh, Carl Book. Well, I mean, everything that we have constructed a kind of alternate universe in which Carl is the most important thing in the world. And I find that universe to be a much more attractive place than the actual universe we live in. So, you know, this Carl Book and Carl's House of Cars, and we've done a lot of things. But Carl, and in all seriousness, you know, Carl has always been the center of our show. He was part of the show from the very beginning. He was the judge and scorekeeper before I was the host. And, you know, in the early days, he was essential to our success because, you know, without him, nobody would have taken it seriously. He was such a beloved figure on NPR as a newscaster that when people heard his voice on our show, I think they were willing to give us a chance that they might not have otherwise because they love Carl so much. And to this day, you know, he really is the heart and soul of Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. I mean, just, you know, without him, I don't think we would have gotten anywhere. And without him, I don't think we really would deserve your time. So we're all grateful to him.
Now, Peter, you, as you stated humbly, you're a nice-looking guy, but do you find that people say, you know, you don't look anything like I thought you would?
Oh, I get that all the time. And what I then ask them is, well, what did you think I look like? And they say, I don't remember. Sometimes people say, oh, I thought you'd be older. Sometimes people say, oh, I thought you'd be younger, which is always nice to hear. Once somebody, an artist, drew and posted on the Internet cartoons of what he thought all of us public radio people looked like just based on our voices. He had never seen pictures. And he drew me as like a 20-something dork with a Jew fro and pointy Spock ears, which I guess I was flattered by. I should let everybody know in Baton Rouge who's coming to see the show, just to save the first 5 minutes where they wouldn't otherwise be listening to me because they'll be in so much shock. I am, in fact, bald. I am a bald man, a proud bald man, and people just tend to stare at me in shock, not realizing that. Apparently, I sound like I have hair. I don't know if that was possible. But Carville and I will look like two white bowling balls there on stage together, just so you know.
Yeah, well, he was a Marine, and he's called himself Corporal Q-Ball on occasion.
Yeah.
And his wife, His wife calls him Serpent Head.
We call him Skeletor. We'll try to see if we say that to his face if we have the guts. Well, he's a guy that I think he would appreciate this if you heard me saying it. He proves that looks aren't everything.
How did Baton Rouge get chosen for this great event?
Well, because we've never been. You know, we one of the things that's great about our show is that unlike most. Well, almost any radio show, with the possible exception of Garrison Keillor, we're a theatrical event. You know, we do the show in front of a live audience every week. When we're home in Chicago, we have a theater here. And that gives us the tremendous advantage of being able to come out on a regular basis and, you know, do the show for people who can't transfer to Chicago. So we do about 12 road shows a year. And let me tell you, you know, we've done all the other cities in America pretty much, from New York to L.A. to Seattle to Boston to Portland, Maine to Portland, Oregon to Miami, Florida. And we felt after all of that, we were finally ready to play Baton Rouge. We didn't want to bring you something that wasn't ready because we know what your standards are like.
What's your favorite place outside of Chicago?
I will say this, and I hope I don't feed into a rivalry that I wouldn't want to, make any worse. But out of all the places, we get greeted with great enthusiasm wherever we go, which is very flattering and very humbling and really fun. But of all the audiences we've ever had, I have to say, the loudest, the most enthusiastic, the craziest, the guys who treated us as if we were rock stars for the most part, was actually New Orleans.
All right, hold that thought. Peter Sagal, saying New Orleans is the best spot outside Chicago for Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. We'll be back in 90 seconds. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. A few more minutes with Peter Sagal, the host of Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, the hour-long weekly radio news panel game show produced by Chicago Public Radio and National Public Radio, heard weekly on WRKF. And next week, as in next Thursday, Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me will be at the Baton Rouge River Center with Peter Sagal, Carl Castle, Tom Baudet, and others, James Carville, all on stage in this amazing production. Peter, when we went to the break, you were saying, outside of Chicago, there's no place like New Orleans. So when were you there?
Now, I'm trying to remember that, and I was trying to remember it while we were off air for a second. I can place it. It was right after the Saints Super Bowl victory.
Well, that would have been 2010.
Yeah, around then. And people were in a very good mood. And, you know, this was at a time when the damage from Katrina was still, even 5 years later, still apparent in various places. The city was still, in some areas, fighting its way out. And these people, the good people of New Orleans, were the happiest and most enthusiastic crowd ever. And I think it speaks to the resilience of that city. Plus, one thing we all have in common across the board in New Orleans, in Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, is a love of eating. One of the things we do is whenever we go to a new city, we spend an inordinate amount of time figuring out where we're going to eat. And as I'm sure you guys know, and maybe you can challenge them for this title, there is no better city to eat and drink in than New Orleans, Louisiana, USA. So we had a great time there. But I don't want to discourage anybody else, and I don't want to be Baton Rouge. Your chance is coming if you think that you can do better. In terms of an enthusiastic response, in terms of some po' boys, we are absolutely willing to give you that chance.
Well, we're up to the task. Next Thursday, you can bet that there'll be a rabid crew of fans assembled to see Peter Sagal and hear Peter and Carl and the others on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. You as we close our discussion, Peter, I think your first love is writing, isn't it?
It was, yeah. That's what I always thought I would do. I mean, this whole sort of talking with my mouth thing out loud to people came along somewhat accidentally. But I was supposed to be a writer when all this began. I wrote plays and screenplays primarily.
Well, and I have a listener who wants to know if you were the writer of Dirty Dancing. Is that right?
Oh, my God. Now, I need to be very, very careful. I did not write Dirty Dancing, a wonderful movie that was written by a woman whose name escapes me right now, but she wrote it about the experience of her own youth, and it's a wonderful thing, and I had nothing to do with that wonderful film. What I did is I wrote an original screenplay at the behest of a producer about the Cuban Revolution, the young girl there who got involved with a revolutionary in the year 1958-59. It was a view of the Cuban Revolution from her perspective. That movie, Eleanor Bergstrom was the woman who wrote Dirty Dancing, a lovely person. That movie that I wrote about Cuba was then taken without my participation, completely rewritten, and made into Dirty Dancing 2 Havana Nights. So
wow.
Basically, they took my setting of the Cuban Revolution. They took Eleanor Bergstrom's plot from Dirty Dancing, i.e. a young girl falls in love with a boy from across the tracks. They enter a dance contest together. And they sort of melded the two of them into this weird mutant thing, which they called Dirty Dancing 2 Havana Nights. And I am standing in my home in Oak Park, Illinois, and looking at my poster for Dirty Dancing Havana Nights. And it is my one of... I love it. I love the fact that this is my contribution to American pop culture. So, you know, it's awesome.
Well,
but no, please make no one make the mistake. I had nothing to do with the wonderful film Dirty Dancing. It was awesome. It was great. Not my doing.
Well, thank you, Peter Sagal. Have a good trip. We'll be waiting for you, and we're accepting the challenge to outdo New Orleans come next Thursday.
It's going to be tough, but I'm sure you guys are up to it. Can I ask you one question before we go? Where should I eat, real quick?
Oh, man, there's so many choices. Do you know where you're staying?
You're
going to be downtown?
Downtown, yeah.
Well, you got Tsunami, if you like sushi. You got Capital.
Sushi, I'm not coming to Louisiana for sushi. I'm coming to Louisiana
for seafood.
Stuff my arteries with for you know, the, well, you the, got the Cajun Creole food.
Poor Boy Lloyd's right across the street from
all right.
The main drag downtown. You got a number of choices downtown. So and if
all
you
right.
want to go out on the town, then it's limitless. And you might even be okay. able to sneak away to New Orleans if you so choose. But we hope you won't do that.
All right, that would seem to be disloyal. I don't know that you're.
Yeah, that we wouldn't like that.
No, we won't.
Okay.
But thank you, and we're looking forward to being there.
Thank you, Peter. Take care.
Bye-bye.
Peter Sagal, fine gentleman, who will be here next Thursday with the crew from Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. And there will be, I'm sure, a special greeting from him from all the listeners of WRKF and fans of the show that airs weekly on this station. This is Jim Engster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. Our guest is Armin Katayan, longtime sports writer and follower of collegiate sports and other major happenings across the globe. And his latest work is The System, The Glory and Scandal of Big-Time College Football. Good morning, Armin Katayan.
Good morning, Jim. How are you?
I'm doing well. Now, your book is it is being bandied as an explosive and revealing portrait reported from behind the scenes, deep behind the scenes, of big-time NCAA college football. What's going on that perhaps the average fan does not know about?
Oh, my God, Jim. There's so much going on that the average fan doesn't know about. I don't know whether the average fan wants to know about it, but you know, it's out there now, and I think it's both as we, you know, there's a reason that the book is has the subtitle of Glory and Scandal. There's a lot of glory in this book. There's a lot to be said about what's good about and what's great about college football, and as it relates to the players themselves and the passion and the loyalty that the fans bring to the game. But, you know, they see the game in really in only two ways. They see it inside the stadium, and they see it on television. And what Jeff Benedict and I, the co-author of the book, have tried to do was to really pull the curtain back on these $80 to $100 million business operations. They're no longer just football programs, and help people understand that these are the component parts of this machine that produces what you see, the spectacle that you see on Saturdays or Thursdays. And some of them are wonderful and really inspiring. Others are kind of dark and dirty, but they're all part of the same. They're all part of the same system, and that's what we tried to do. We tried to do it in a way that's not salacious, it's not sensationalized, but it's through the eyes of the people that have lived it and experienced it, and through our eyes as we got what I would say is unprecedented access into programs like Alabama and Washington State and BYU and Michigan and several others.
Well, these $100 million budgets are not with everybody, but certainly they are with many programs across the country now, including LSU. It is a big business, and as a result of that, sometimes people do things in big business that they would not do in games for fun. So are we talking about scandals here that perhaps are not being reported? What did your findings unearth?
Well, I think what happens is that, you know, everything is escalating. The coaching salaries are going through the roof. You have now 79 coaches and of major Division I football that are making more than $1 million a year. You have 16 that are making more than $3 million. You have two that are making more than $5 million. You have tens of millions of dollars being poured into football facilities and stadium expansions and players' lounges so the teams can bring in what are the most valuable commodity, which are the 4- and 5-star recruits to these mega programs. So everything's going up. So at the same time, the NCAA is trying to change the equation and making strides and a conscious effort to ferret out the cheaters. The problem is that a couple of things. One, the risk-reward calculus is in favor of the cheaters at the moment because the NCAA just isn't capable of finding it all the problems. And two, the money now is moving silently. There's just the cheaters have gotten so much smarter than they were in the past. Nobody's writing checks and depositing them into parents' accounts anymore. Nobody's buying cars for athletes that are traceable through the car dealership. These are now all one or two or three removed from the principals involved, and a lot of times they're just pure cash deals. So, what we tried to do was to help people understand what goes on with not only the value of a 4 or 5 star recruit, as we show out of Texas, the enormous offer of $300,000 or more to the father of Ricky Seals-Jones, who was recruited by LSU right up until the last minute. I think LSU and A&M were the last two in the game for Ricky Seals, not saying LSU was involved in anything unsavory. But in what's the role of a hostess? What's the role of a tutor? What does a football director of football operations do? So all of those component parts of the system are really part and parcel of the book.
The book is The System, The Glory and Scandal of Big-Time College Football by Armin Katayan, the man we're visiting with, and Jeff Benedict. And Armin has been writing, as I stated, for many years, going back to his days at Sports Illustrated. You have been unearthing things like this for a long time, Armin. Is it worse now than it's ever been?
I think it's better in a lot of ways, but I think it's I'm not sure where this train is headed. I know in college football that I know what the fuel is. The fuel is money pouring into the system like never before. The prospects now on the horizon of a national football playoff where ESPN is going to spend a little north of $400 million for the multimedia rights to televise three games, the two semifinal games and the championship game. I know that the athletes are on board and they're fueling the system. I'm just not sure who's sitting in the conductor's seat. I'm not sure if it's Mark Emmert of the NCAA, who says in our book he really doesn't know where all this is headed, where all the money's pouring in the sport. And we all know for a time schools were bolting conferences in order to get better deals with TV conference deals. And we certainly don't know. I don't know if it's Mike Slive in the SEC or if it's Jim Delaney at the Big Ten or if it's one of the college presidents who's going to step up and say, look, we've got to put the brakes on here. And I don't know who's going to have that courage to figure out that we need a better system in place, particularly to protect the athletes, because as I said, they're the single most valuable commodity here.
Now, Mark Emmert, the man you mentioned, is a former chancellor at LSU, former chancellor at Connecticut, former president of the University of Washington, and he's the one who opened the vault back in 1999 when he was at LSU and paid Nick Saban then the unheard of sum of $1.2 million a season. Made Saban the second or third highest paid coach in America, and at that time he was a 48-year-old journeyman. But how many million-dollar coaches are there now, Armin?
I believe the last count there were 79 making more than $1 million a year.
Well, has Emmert been complicit in this?
Well, I think Mark Emmert is a really interesting man. I think in many ways he's a change agent right now. Whether he was, I think he certainly was when he was at LSU, when he paid Nick what he paid him. I think he's trying to drag the NCAA and the association into the 21st century to make the rules less complicated. But at the same time, he wants to make the cheaters and the results of cheating more punitive, because frankly, right now, as I said, the risk reward calculus favors the programs that are willing to break the rules. And the problem is that, and we discussed this at length in one of the chapters, is that Mark made a huge bet on his enforcement staff. They buttressed the staff. They brought in more investigators, and they really targeted Miami, the University of Miami, as the one school that they were going to drop the hammer on to send a message to all the other cheaters that the cheaters will not profit. We're gonna take you out, essentially, and send a message to everybody else. The problem is that the worst possible time, the NCAA got caught cheating. It got breaking its own rules in order to get a couple of people that were key to their investigation, they believed were key to their investigation, to to commit to an interview, and it blew up in the NCAA's face. And the result is that they have they've kind of gone under the desk right now, and the morale and the enforcement staff is really bottoming out. And so, obviously and honestly, if you were looking to cheat right now in college football, it's a pretty good time to do it because the NCAA is kind of on the run, and they're running in the wrong direction.
Well, you refer to the so-called athlete students working full-time with oceans of money going to other people who don't graduate and end up with broken bodies in the process. Do you sense that the movement toward paying these athlete students is such that it can't be stopped, that at some point it's bound to happen?
I think, Jim, that the paying is the word that I would put a circle around or quotes around. I think it's inevitable that there will be stipends that are delivered monthly to athlete students who are involved in these mega programs and in the top football programs, because as you said, they're working full-time jobs. The kids at LSU, I mean, this is an 11-month-a-year job. They don't have any time to go out and work. And when they do, it's only for 2 weeks. And if you look at the Ohio State situation, those kids work for 2 weeks, and maybe they got paid a few extra hours that they didn't work. And then here comes the NCAA police force saying, wait a second, you got overpaid by $197.50. I mean, really? When you can sit in the Ohio State bookstore and watch $197.50 evaporate in 10 seconds, you know, at a cash register. So I think that if they were smart, and I think they are smart, they just have to figure out how to do it. These programs that are in the SEC and the Big 12 and the Pac-12 and the Big 10 and the ACC are going to move towards getting more money in the hands monthly with some sort of a stipend. And if that means paying under Title IX, the women's programs, I'm all for it. They got to figure out some way to do it.
Well, it's all detailed in the system, which has been proclaimed the definitive book on the college game. And this is from Armin Katayan, who is a veteran of Sports Illustrated, now a CBS News correspondent, and the winner of 11 Emmy Awards. Thank you, Armin. Very nice to share some time with you today.
And my pleasure talking to you, Jim. Thank you very much.
Thank you. And LSU plays tomorrow night, 17.5-point favorites over Auburn. 2-3-0 teams colliding at Tiger Stadium. That brings us to Gene Shea. He is a legendary Philadelphia disc jockey. Some of the titles for Gene are the Dean of American Folk DJs, the Grandfather of Philadelphia Folk Music. He knew and admired the work of Jim Croce, who died on this date, September 20th, 1973, in Natchitoches, flying out of Natchitoches after a performance at Northwestern State University. Today there will be a remembrance of Jim Croce at Natchitoches, and this is appropriate as part of the Meat Pie Festival in that area, and a plaque that was missing for some time honoring Croce and bandmate Marty Mulison, who also died in the crash outside of the campus. Vanished, a new plaque will be displayed, and this great singer will be honored. And we will talk about him with Gene Shea in 90 seconds. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. J.C. Kane producing. Your number is 877-217-5757 and 297-5633. Remember September 20th, 1973, for those of us who are old enough to be alive on that date. That night, the big event in the United States was the Battle of the Sexes in Houston at the Astrodome, where Billie Jean King beat Bobby Riggs in straight sets. But a tragedy took place in Natchitoches, Louisiana, as 30-year-old Jim Croce died in a plane crash after a performance at Northwestern State University. A man who knew him and admired his work, Gene Shea, is with us. Good morning, Gene.
Morning, Jim.
And Gene is joining us from the fighting city of Philadelphia, where there will be celebrations that you're involved with regarding Jim Croce. What's going
yes,
on?
Indeed.
What's going on there?
Well, we're having the memorial concert for Jim and for Maury, and that's actually one day later than the actual anniversary, which is today. Is that right?
That is correct.
and your anniversary is right on target, but I guess we had to worry about the logistics, the best place to do the show. And in this case, the best place happens to be a wonderful high school auditorium. It's really oversized for a high school, but they put a lot of emphasis on performing arts. They have musical comedies there all the time, and that happens to be the high school where Jim went to high school.
Well, 7 years was all that Jim Croce was on the scene, but he was a magnificent singer and songwriter. Some say a better songwriter than singer, but he was phenomenal, wasn't he?
Well, pretty good in both areas, I always thought. I mean, at the time, it was part of the big folk revival in the United States, and the singer-songwriter was just bursting, out of their shells, and people started writing their own songs. You know, when Jim started singing in his early days and right out of college, during college last year, he was singing traditional folk music, pretty much old blues that he'd learned and songs that he heard from Pete Seeger and Lead Belly and the Weavers. And I don't know exactly when the bug bit him to be creative on his own, but whatever it was fortuitous because he did it well. You know, he came up with great themes like Operator, Time in a Bottle, universal themes that people could identify with. He was good at that, and he was also one of these really laid-back, very gentlemanly. He was an affable guy that everybody seemed to like. He put an audience at ease. And I have to say that same thing happened with Maury Muehlheisen. And by the way, who was his accompanist, his friend and traveling companion, but he played a very good lead guitar for Jim, and they got along very well on stage, and you could see in their faces how much they enjoyed working with one another. I was just going to add, Jim, if you don't mind, that this is a whole, listening to your commentary earlier, you have a whole different way of it's like a whole different pronunciation guide for me, a lot of people say Croce with a soft C in the middle. You
right.
Croce. Like it's almost like crocheting.
Mm-hmm.
Here in Philadelphia, where he was headquartered here pretty much, we say Croce. We make the
right.
Hard C. The town where the university is, I would call it Nacogdoches, and you say Nacogdoches.
Well,
right, and there's another one, too. Maury Muehlheisen is the way we say it. You say Maury. The accents are different.
I'm sure you're right on both counts, but and I know his son has been
AJ,
a fantastic performer too, and takes great pride in who his father was, and his
wife too, who has a wonderful restaurant with Jim Croce's name, and it's full of memorabilia. Now, she has moved to a new restaurant, but I'm sure it's going to be very much like the other one.
How well did you know Jim Croce?
Well enough to hang out with him. I'd pick him up occasionally and take him to a gig that I was emceeing. In those days, there was a hootenanny craze going on, and everybody thought it was very hip to have a hootenanny. And I say everybody, I mean small colleges in the Philadelphia metropolitan area and out in the burbs, they would say, hey, let's have a little, and they would, sometimes they call me and they say, do you have anybody that would be good for hootenanny? I say, yeah, I got a perfect guy, Jim Croce. And they said, yeah, I think we heard of him. Now, of course, this is before Don't Mess Around with Jim and Bad Leroy Brown, any of those songs. It was just at the point where he started to write those songs. And when they caught on, he suddenly got on the charts. I'm trying to remember the magazine there was, a Billboard, I guess, charts. Suddenly he got national attention. He was number one for a number of times for a number of songs. And they were songs that were very much unlike him in his personality. He wasn't a bad Jim Croce what's the other one? Don't Mess Around with Jim. That was very much not the kind of person he was. He was very easy to get to know, to like, had a great sense of humor.
Well, and like many singers, his best work was probably the music that was not as heralded or embraced as much as Bad Leroy Brown, and You Don't Mess Around with Jim, but both of those are pretty good.
Yeah, they're both pretty catchy, but, the folk crowd thought that he had pretty much left the fold. He wasn't doing folk music anymore. He was doing his own songs. There's there are some no-nos in folk music, and the traditionalists like to hear the old songs, pretty sero, and, you know, songs like that. I'm trying to think, there are only 50 million of those songs floating around in my head, but sometimes when I'm looking for the one particular one that's representative, you know.
Well, you know, the tomorrow, when you have your celebration in Philadelphia for Jim Croce, one of the great native sons, it will mark the 40th anniversary of the release of I've Got a Name. That was released the day after Jim Croce died in Natchitoches.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And it is, I think, one of his best songs and one that has stood the test of time. We hear it quite frequently. J.C.?
Singing bird in the croaking toe, I've got a name, I've got a name. And I carry it with me like my daddy did, but I'm living the dream that he kept here. Moving me down the highway, rolling me down the highway, moving ahead so life won't.
Great Jim Croce, died much too young, only 30 years old, Gene Shea. Mm-hmm. No telling what he would have done.
You know, one more thing I should mention, that is, I just read this morning that A.J. Croce, Jim's son, was signed to a big record contract with Compass Records, which is one of the most creative and also one of the best and popular of the independent record producers. So that's great for him.
Mm-hmm. Between 66 and 73, Jim Croce released 5 albums, 11 singles. His first album, 1966, was released with 500 copies pressed. It's called Facets, and it was financed with a $500 wedding gift.
Mm-hmm.
In 7 years, he went from anonymity to superstardom.
I know, isn't that amazing? And he sang with his wife Ingrid, didn't he, originally?
Yeah, he did. A Villanova man, he was on the brink of a long and successful career at the heights of the music world when he was killed in a plane crash. And legend has it that he was performing in Natchitoches at Northwestern State as a favor to a friend of his he had met in the Army National Guard. And,
It didn't work. It was a makeup. Hadn't they planned to do that earlier?
Yep.
Another time? And they changed the date?
Mm-hmm.
He had been in Philadelphia for the festival that I started back in the 60s, just a few weeks earlier. It's always the middle of August, and it's called the Philadelphia Folk Festival. And I introduced both Jim and Maury on stage. It was basically the star was Jim. So when Jim Croce was there, he was very much appreciated and got a lot of good applause and screams from the crowd, outdoor situation. It's summertime. But that's the last time I saw him, and I couldn't believe it when it came so close to that August, you know, when the plane went down.
Well, in addition to Croce and Mühlhausen, did I get it right that time? Or pretty close?
But it might be fine for you.
No, I think you're right. I'm sure you are. There were 4 other people who were killed in that crash, including
right.
The pilot, Robert Elliott, a comedian named George Stevens. He was the warm-up act, I think.
Yes.
Croce's manager and booking agent and the road manager, they all died as well.
And within seconds of getting, you know, they just took off and went boom into a tree and it turned over, whatever else happened, and they went all. They
a
were
pecan
all gone.
Tree yeah, at the end of the runway. That was it. And it's sad, but Jim Croce's music has lived for 4 decades, and my guess is that he'll be popular for many more years. He was something special.
He was, and his music will outlast him, and we'll be thinking about him, and I will, since I've known him, you know, I always think about him, quite frankly.
Yeah, I remember seeing him on the talk show circuit in those days when, you know, the Tonight Show was prevalent.
Oh, yeah. And make a guest appearance kind of thing. Sing a song, say hello to the host, and be on your way.
Yeah, he was magnificent and humble, as you state. He wasn't the bravado guy who's in Bad Leroy Brown.
Very kind, gentle. You know, he was living for a while in the Pennsylvania Dutch Amish country outside of Philadelphia, and a couple of times when I saw him, he was wearing Amish garb, you know, like a little black vest and wearing one of those big wide-brimmed black hats like you see the elders wear them when they're buggy. You know, the people there are very the plain people, and they ride buggies, and they don't, you know, they don't drive cars, and they don't drink, and you know what I mean? And he was, when I picked him up one time to go to Hootenanny out at Widener University, his wife was with him, and when I met him in Philadelphia, there he was wearing this big hat, and I said, Jim, I thought you were going to be selling me shoe fly pies or something, your apple panned out of yours, you know. And he said, no, you know, that's what we wear out here, and it's a nice thing that we're out in the sun, and I love the country out here. It's a great country.
Well,
he was quite a guy.
The man we're talking with is Gene Shea, who's been doing this for more than half a century, since 1962, and I have to thank Taylor Caffrey for putting me in touch
with
him.
He's a good man, Dan
Taylor.
He
is, and he'll be on tomorrow night with Hootenanny Power on WRKF. You were speaking of folk singers, Gene, you were the first to bring Bob Dylan to Philadelphia, weren't you?
That's right. Not too many people knew who he was, but my wife and I received, in those days, the albums would all come to my house. There were 33 and a third, you remember them, Jim.
Mm-hmm.
And we got one with a little cute picture of Dylan on the cover. It was just called Bob Dylan on Columbia. And we started listening to it. I had never heard anybody take liberties with folk music, traditional music, like Man of Constant Sorrow and, you know, Fenario, and do it in a way that was so interesting. And I thought, my God, this guy's unbelievable. So when it came time to put a concert on for the Philadelphia group called the Folk Song Society, a nonprofit, my wife volunteered. She said, let's put on a concert. And then she whispered, hey, why don't we get Bob Dylan? I said, sure, nobody knows who he is. We can get him for cheap. I wasn't really thinking that because I know that if you're not well known, you know. So we got him for, I think, $150. He came in and he came by train. We picked him up, and he and his girlfriend, Susie Rotolo, who are on the cover of the Freewheelin' Bob Dylan album. And he played a very small room, and only 35 to 40 people showed up. Who is he? Who is this guy? But the people who did know him had a concert of their life and got to meet him, and it was very cool.
Was that his first concert?
Oh, not his first concert. He'd been doing shows in New York and singing at a place called Gertie's Folk City, and everybody in New York, all the Greenwich Village people knew who he was. He had just moved there from Minnesota, you know, and then he went to college, University of Minnesota. So he was quite a character. He dressed sort of funny, and he was very clever and very witty with his words, and you know, he was a kid, you know, he just fresh-faced kid, then he took on this whole persona of somebody had like a lot of mystery about them. You know, he never wanted to answer questions with a straight answer. He'd say, "Well, I might think of that." And then he would also took on affected voice. And it was, "Hey, well, yeah, sure, you." He used to listen to Ramblin' Jack Elliott and, of course, Woody Guthrie, and that's the way they talked. That's where he started singing.
It was 50 years ago in Philadelphia,
right.
1963. Gene Mauth was managing the Phillies, and Bob Dylan was on stage. What was the name of the place?
It was called the Ethical Society on Rittenhouse Square, which is right in the center of town.
Mm-hmm.
Ironically, Arlo Guthrie wrote a song about Philadelphia's Rittenhouse Square when he was almost arrested for dancing in a shut-down water fountain on the city square there. Rittenhouse is a pretty classy area with a lot of wealthy older people. He decided one night to go to a candy shop with some of his friends. They got ice cream cones, and they started dancing around in the fountain, and some plainclothes policemen tried to, you know, they said, what are you guys doing here? He said, oh, nothing, we're just walking through the square, you know. And the square was only like one block by one block, but it's a famous square. And he wrote a song about it called The Ring Around the Rosy Rag. Arlo Guthrie did.
Yeah.
And he basically says it happened in Philadelphia. Because the club he was playing was called the Second Fred. It was right around the corner from that square.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sure Jim Croce knew that square well, too. It was like a centerpiece of a center city area. It's very popular.
Right. Well, we're short on time, but you must have known Dick Clark.
Oh, I sure did. I worked at WABC there. I worked when he was doing the radio bandstand originally, and I knew him just to say hi to, not really well. I wasn't doing radio music at that time. No, I started when I was a junior in college at a professional station, you know.
Well, Gene Shea, an honor to share the microphone with you. And
Same here, Jim.
The celebration in honor of Jim Croce goes well tomorrow in Philadelphia, as I'm sure it will.
Yeah, same for your celebration and your memorial. Best wishes to all you guys out there in L.A., that L.A.
Yeah.
And thanks for calling.
And I'll do so again. Thank you, Gene.
Okay.
Take care.
See you now.
Appreciate it.
Bye-bye.
And that'll do it for this week. Jim Croce, born January 10th, 1943 in Philadelphia, died September 20th, 1973 in Natchitoches, Louisiana. 30 years old, 40 years ago tonight. For J.C. Kane, I'm Jim Inkster. Hope you have a great weekend. We'll be back Monday. Until then, thank you for listening and stay tuned.
Podcasts of The Jim Inkster Show are available at WRKF.org. The Jim Inkster Show is produced in association with the Louisiana Radio Network and is copyrighted by WRKF for the private use of its audience. Any other use of any portion of this program without the written consent of WRKF is prohibited. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the views of WRKF, its officers, and members.